1.7 volts AC ripple. So he's asking, do you think he should just shotgun it, change the two large filters, or do you have another recommendation for that, Dick? Back to you, KC2WGB.
It would be nice to know, is the Astron power supply rated for 30 watts?
35 amperes.
So it's rated for 35 amperes, and do you know what current level he's using it at with that rig, Eric? John, go ahead.
He claims he's running 70 watts, so at 12 volts. It's up there, but it's not over the power supply.
I see 13 volts at 10 amperes with the 130 watts input, but the amplifier is not that sufficient. So he's probably drawing 15, 18 amperes on a 35 amp power supply. And for that power supply to fade from 13.7 volts down to 11.6, if that's not right, something in that power supply is heating up and fading. Could it be the filter capacitors? That's possible. By measuring the amount of AC ripple on those filter capacitors inside the power supply, that'll give him a hint. What's that ripple when it's hot, when it's cold? If they're electrolytic capacitors and they're 15 years old and they're starting to dry out, that's a factor. 1.7 volt AC says that we're dropping out of regulation. The regulator is trying to maintain 13.7, but the raw voltage going into the regulator is dropping down to some level, some lower voltage, and that's where the 1.7 volt AC is coming from. Let me drop.
Also, Dick, he mentioned that he examined the printed circuit board. There's no scarred or burned components and nothing running, you know, hot. It seems to be normal, just an added notation.
When you're on the AC scale of a digital multimeter, you're measuring RMS voltage. So when he's down to the 11.6 volts under load, and he's 1.7 volts AC, that's RMS. 1.7 volts AC is probably 5 volts peak to peak if he looked at that voltage on an oscilloscope. Some number like that. So it certainly looks like we're dropping way out of regulation. And the easiest way for a regulator to drop out of regulation is to give you 60 cycle or 120 cycle AC waveform is for the raw voltage on the filter capacitors to be fading. They're not, the filter capacitors are not doing. So right now, of the clues that we've been given, the filter capacitors and the power supply are pretty high up on the list of suspects of what's causing this failure. And by looking at the AC voltage with an oscilloscope, if possible, AC coupled oscilloscope, on those capacitors, that would give you a strong clue that the 500 microfarad capacitor is faded down to 5 microfarads when it gets hot, because it's an aluminum electrolytic capacitor and it's drying out. So that's a high suspect as I see it. It's also, let me drop it. There's a slim possibility that the power supply transformer feeds a bridge rectifier set of diodes, and the diodes get hot and start to having a back leakage current. Unlikely, but it can happen. So, second of the list of suspects would be the bridge rectifier. But I think the filter capacitors are way up near the top. There's various ways you can test them, like an oscilloscope or your AC voltmeter. Put directly on those filter capacitors to see what's happening for the raw voltage going into that voltage regulator that's trying to maintain 13.7. And that poor thing is being starved of all the evidence that I'm hearing. You've got to be a little bit careful about your digital voltmeter. When you've got simultaneous DC and AC present, sometimes it gives you funny readings. On some digital voltmeters, there is a, in the case of a triplet volt ohm milliammeter, there used to be a so-called AC input connector, which was capacitively coupled. And now the DC component on a filter capacitor can be removed. You're only looking at the AC component and making that reading. But with a good oscilloscope, you can find out what's going on. So the filter capacitors in that power supply, if they're more than 5 or so years old, they could give you this characteristic, 5 or 10, depending on what brand name. So way it sounds, John. KC2WGB, K2IW in TechNet. Drag your feet in case someone else has some Estron power supply experience they can give us. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. All right, yeah, I agree. I think that's going to be his best bet. Two capacitors that he claims are in there, they're not too expensive. So I think that's the way he should go, and I think that'll clear up his problem. And yes, it's well over 10 years. I think he said it's like 14 years old, something like that. So it's probably due. All right, I'll let it drop and pick up the last one.
By the way, John, he could do a temporary experiment. If the filter capacitors are failing because the 500 microfarads, I put the number out of the air, degraded to 5 microfarads, which is much too little. And now he's got another 500 microfarad capacitor in his hand, so to speak. And with clip leads or temporary soldering, he puts it in parallel with the capacitor that's in the power supply. And if the bad characteristics disappear, that would be a secondary way of proving the original filter capacitors have gone way down in the capacitance in microfarads. And now, even before you unwire the old ones, by way of that parallel capacitor test, you get a strong clue that you're on the right path. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, with the Astron, there's a couple of ways you could do that, right on the output connectors, or I believe on the 35-amp Astron, that capacitor is mounted with the terminals up, so all he has to do is take the cover off, and he'd be able to get at that one large one, and that might be a good thing for him to do, and he'd be able to tell right away. He should notice the difference instantaneously. But I noticed the fact that it'll operate for the first few minutes fine and then fade off. I got a feeling the cap is opening up.
Yeah, hold on a minute here, John. Well, you said he can use the output connector. There I disagree. Yes, he's getting 1.7 volts AC with a DC voltage of 11.6 volts on the output connector. To put a great big filter capacitor there is too little, too late, too far downrange. The raw voltage going into the voltage regulator, right after the bridge rectifier, you go into those first great big filter capacitors. That's the voltage that needs a great big capacitor way upstream. Now, those leads are not brought to the output connector. So putting an big capacitor on the output connectors, I don't think it's going to give you the right answer, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
I'll agree with you. It depends. I'm used to working with such large caps that it does make quite a difference and would show an improvement right away. Yeah, but he's better off. I mean, there's only 4 screws there. He's got the cover off. He can flip right onto that cap, and I think it's going to be that large one, I think it's a blue Mallory, nice size cap with screws on top. That's probably the baby that's open.
And one of the things that I've discovered is that you go to a real motor start capacitor, high quality Mallory, for instance, sprayed motor start capacitor of the right number of microfarads and DC voltage rating. Use a quality capacitor in there, and that power supply may be good for the next 30 years, in my opinion. Over to you, John.
Yeah, I agree. Good rugged stuff. All right. Maybe I think we've got that. Let me go on to the next page. I'll pick up my last question. Dick, by the way, Lou, NY2H, just brought up an interesting point that he should also check the screws on that capacitor that they haven't loosened up. That has been a history in some of those Astron supplies, so that's a good recommendation. That was by NY2H.
And I didn't hear him through the repeater. Was he talking to you in the chat room or some other means? How was Lou talking? What was the mysterious process by which Lou was getting in the back door and talking to you directly, John? Go ahead.
Oh, because he's so clever, so evil. Yeah, he typed it right in on the chat room. I'm sorry, on Echo Link.
B2HWW, please.
Let's see what Howie's got to say on all this. I bet you fixed a few Astron power supplies. W2HWW, K2IW. Go ahead, Howie.
Exactly what I think is happening. Maybe losing one of the two of his transistors. You should feel all the transistors to see which one is cold. If you lose one of the transistors, what's going to happen is you're not going to have enough gain, DC, and you're going to have feedback. Remember, you don't want to put a capacitor on the output of the supply because you're past the regulator stage. There's a four-way bridge rectifier with the capacitor. Then it goes into a regulator, you know, then it goes to the pass transistors. And the pass transistors get their unregulated voltage from the output of the filter cap. I can tell you, Dick, that one of the problems with Astron is they don't have enough transistors to do the job, that they're underrated. And what I've done, I've had their power supply, modified their power supplies, where I've had 12 transistors. I have an Astron 60 running at around 60 amps continuous. And what I did was I added four more transistors. And you also have to make sure you put the right balancing resistors in there, you know, the emitter resistors. But I would check the pass transistors.
That's a good suggestion, and I thank you, Howie. And the pass transistors, are they well heat sunk? Are they not screwed down tight enough with the right grease? And so with poor heat sinking of the transistors, they could be running extra hot. So carefully putting your finger on the transistors to see which ones are hot could give you some further clues. Thank you for that, Howie. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Okay, cool stuff. Yeah, it's such a popular supply. Everybody's had some odds and ends, and that was good that Lou picked that up, because I remember that happening a couple of times on some of those, and I remember reading about it in some of the articles. Okay, let me let it drop, and I'll go on to the last question. This was right up your alley, Dick.
One more comment, please.
Yeah, Howie recognized that for the loose screw to every time you turn on the power supply cause a voltage drop to go from 13.7 down to 11.6. For a loose screw to do that, to make contact in the exact same slow sequence during heat up every time, possible but unlikely. Let's hear what Howie can say on this. WV2HWW, K2RIW, go ahead, Howie.
Why you want to check these transistors? If the transistor is cold and the other ones are hot, that tells you that transistor is blown. That's a way of you knowing that the transistor is not working. If that transistor is open or has no more gain, then you have no, you know, you don't have a current drop across there. You don't have current going through that transistor. You don't have a voltage drop. Better be careful what I say. I don't want somebody to take away my degree. But across that transistor, you have a voltage difference. And that's, you know, current times that voltage difference is going to give you a power dissipation. So whatever transistor is cold is probably not working. Now, in a case like that, I don't know if it would be a transistor, because it should happen immediately, that you should go from no load to full load. But if it's taking your time, it sounds like a capacitor. Could it be the regulator? Remember, that's a 723 regulator with feedback, Dick.
Yeah, whether or not all of the transistors in there are sharing the load correctly, and if there are emitter sharing resistors, you know, 0.2 ohm or something like that, in each of the emitters to make sure they're all sharing the current. By measuring the voltage drop across each of those emitter 0.2 ohm, in my example, resistors, we can find out real fast how hard each one of those transistors is working. Are some of them drawing the full current, and some of them drawing no current at all, so to speak. So there's lots of different ways with your digital multimeter, put in the right place, looking for the right waveform, sometimes with an oscilloscope, to really find out what's going on in that power supply. Good hints. Thank you, Howie. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. Yeah, unfortunately, he only has a digital multimeter, and he did check the two pass transistors, and, you know, they forward biased, and they read all right. He doesn't think that's the problem. I'll try one more time. Let it drop, and I'll go on to my last question.
When it comes to power transistors in a service like that, measuring forward and reverse voltage drop across the emitter base junction and base collector junction, that test is necessary but not sufficient. Not putting it under working load, if you know what I mean. So don't be too quick to judge that the transistors are perfect because they passed that test, John. KC2WGB, K2RAW in the TechNet.
WH2CDL has information.
Wait for the beeps and go right ahead, Andy.
I had the same problem with mine. There's two secondary windings on the power transformer. Low current and high current. Turns out the diodes, the high current diodes were open. So it was being, current was being drawn by the low current winding. And the bridge rectifier, not the two diodes. This is two separate diodes. That was the problem. I would have them check the diodes in the high current side of the secondary.
With that mode of failure, you're going to have lower than normal output voltage, a lot more output ripple, not quite regulation. But with that mode of failure that you just described, Andy, would that, every time you turn on the power supply, when it's cold, give you 13.7 volts, and under load, as things heat up, it fades down to 11.6 volts with a lot of AC ripple coming out? Would those diode failures go through the exact same thermal diagram, if you know what I mean, every time you turn it on? Would that fit your description, Andy? W2CDL, K2RAW.
That's exactly what happened to mine. Same scenario. There was no high current because the both diodes in the high current side of the secondary were open. So I was getting voltage from the low current side, from the other secondary. It was leaking through, but it could not take a load. So I haven't checked the high current diode.
So where it starts off giving you a good load, output voltage current, when it's cold, are you saying those diodes themselves, the high current diodes, were heating up and failing, and that's what gave you the drooping voltage each time you put it under load and waited 10 minutes? Over to you, Andy.
No, I didn't see that. I just saw the diodes were open, period. And there was that delay that you're talking about from where it drops off, but there's a droop in the voltage. So, that would be my suggestion. Just check the high current diodes with an ohm meter and see if they're open. So that's what I saw.
Okay, I thank you. Some good suggestions. You got it, John.
Okay, this young gentleman has a piece of test equipment that has a delay line in it. Okay, he has to replace the delay line, about a 10-meter delay line. It's a 150-ohm delay line. His question is, can he parallel two 300-ohm TD flatline antennas, and then he can provide shielding for that? Could he make it up, and would that satisfy the 150-ohm requirement? Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, I'm a little doubtful on this one. Making your impedance right because you're putting a pair of 300-ohm leads in parallel does give you a calculated 150 ohms, a 10-meter, 30-foot delay line. I wonder what is the evidence that the delay line has failed, and if that delay line is part of an oscilloscope, it's part of the triggering circuit, for instance, without using the original equipment, the original component, is his oscilloscope, if that's what it is, it's going to come back to full calibrated operation. I'm a bit worried. I'm not going to say it's not going to work. I'm just saying it's a rather unconventional technique. I haven't heard of anyone using that. So let me repeat the question. What's the evidence that the existing delay line has failed? KC2WGB, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Good question, Dick. What happened was, the power supply in this device, it's a pulse distribution device. All it does is put out pulses, and this is one of the delay lines that are in there. There's several delay lines that are used for different functions. And when the power supply burnt, there was a carbon resistor near it, and it just melted right through that cable like it was butter. So, and he has had trouble trying to get a replacement for this device. So that he was just trying to find something simple because he can't find a... It's a dual conductor, shielded, 150 ohm line that's 10 meters long.
Okay, so a resistor got hot, melted through the cable, and if it melted through at one end, to trim back the cable, and the 30 meter delay line becomes, 10 meter delay line becomes 9.9 meters, that's not much of a problem. If the middle of the delay line gets melted, you cut out that section, and carefully, with a good microscope, a magnifying glass, you reconnect everything back again. I suspect that a crafty person can take a failed delay line of this melting phenomenon and put it back together and get 95% of the performance to get it back into service, is my guess. To be able to replace that piece of delay line, which is an exotic component, is going to be troublesome. And to start off with a dual shield, a double center conductor leaded coaxial cable, and try to substitute 150 ohm and piece between the two inner shielded leads. And now to take unshielded 300 ohm twin leads, a pair of them in parallel, to try to make a substitute delay line. I think that can give you a fair amount of grief, of improper shielding, and so on. So, and to make the time constant, the delay line probably had a particular velocity factor. The fact that it's 10 meters long doesn't mean that it's 10 meters long electronically. Let me drop this. So no matter how that cable was melted, cutting out that section and rejoining to repair that cable would be my first response if you're unable to buy that component. So you got very little to lose. I mean, if at worst your attempted repair ends up with not the best connection, a little bit less than ideal shielding, it might still do the job, if you know what I mean. So a crafty person with the right kind of optical magnification where he's doing the repair, I think there's a 95% chance he can put that cable back in service by cutting out the bad section and rejoining. KC2WGB, K2RIW, that's what I would have done.
Excellent recommendation, but it's going to be difficult to do that because if you've ever seen how the delay lines are put in, like the Tektronix oscilloscope, they're in a loop. They'll make maybe it's a 6-inch coil or a 10-inch coil, and they may have 8 or 10 loops in that. This is done the same way. When the resistor burnt, it burnt through multiple conductor areas and did a lot of damage to that cable. But, you know, good recommendation. Well, I don't know. I think maybe he can keep trying to locate a piece of equipment that may have one or two components that are 150 ohm leads, and he might be able to luck out that way. I don't think I don't think he can do any damage. He's not, you know, it's not going to blow up on him. He could try it and see if it works. That's the only thing I can say. I know there is 300 ohm shielded two conductor, and he could possibly parallel two of those if he's. But I know he can just put the two cables together if he wants to do that, and then pull shielding over it later if that's important. Yeah, good stuff. Difficult thing to repair.
You've got a good suggestion there, John. I completely forgot about 300 ohm shielded twin lead, a rare product that used to exist back in the dark ages when you and I were cutting our teeth in electronics. I haven't seen anything like that recently, but it's got to exist. You go to the Belden catalog, they've got it. And it's going to be a lot more bulky than this delay line. But if there's a way you can find room to put it, so shielded 300 ohm twin lead, the right length of a pair of those in parallel, that sounds like it's got to work. Good suggestion. Over to you, John.
Well, I know what it's like to be in that situation, and so do you. So you'll try anything to get it to work. And he was just worried if he may damage anything by doing that. And I don't think he can damage anything as long as he has the connections proper. You know, everything connected properly, he'll have no problem at all. Whether or not it's going to give him the exact timing sequence he needs, that he'll be able to check with other instruments as he goes. But all right. Very good. I think we've covered it all. Yes. So, time to go over to Paul and his magnificent space report.
Okay. Let me give one quick call to John. KD2IXB, John, I wonder if you're back with us. You're one of the guys on the list that we didn't get to. Over to you, John, if you're there. K2LIW.
I know what he was looking to ask, Dick.
Yeah, but he's the guy who wants the answer. But go ahead and tell me what he was looking to ask. Maybe he's already communicated with you. And maybe he's one of these guys who was up around the clock at his field day site. And therefore, he's tired as all hell. I came home and crashed after being up around the clock at the field day sites I went to. So tell us what John was asking. John number one, KC2WGB, KQIW.
KC2WGB. Yes, John had called me before the TechNet, and he wanted to know if he could ask a question about getting some help, if he could ask somebody. He needs five PL259 connectors soldered, and he's not able to do that himself. He just wanted to know if there was anybody around that could possibly help him or if you could recommend somebody. So at least it's out there, people know, and they have his call sign, so maybe they could get in touch with him. And I do talk to him every, you know, other day or something like that, so if anything comes up, I'd be able to let him know.
And by way of playing back the TechNet on amateurradio.tango, Victor, you can hear what we're saying. John, KD2IXP, lives in Jericho, New York, on the roster for LIMARC. He's listed in Jericho. His address, his telephone number, his website is there. There's lots of ways that people can get a hold of John. Jericho is probably not too far from some of the people like Andy, the B2CDL, who can easily help him with doing things like that. So I'm pretty sure with a club of 400 members called LIMARC on Long Island, and KD2IXP is living in the middle of Long Island, there's help out there. We just got to get them together. How about you, John? KC2WGB, K2REW, and the TechNet. Oh, wait a minute. I guess it's time for the... I'll go back to you, John, for any final on that before we go over to the space report. Over to you, John, K2REW.
KC2WGB. Very good, Dick. I didn't know that he had all that information listed there, but that's excellent. You know, he has a heart unit that he wears, and some things are a little difficult for him to do. That's why he was asking for this help, so it'd be nice if somebody could help him out. But we'll see what happens. Okay, Dick, back to you. And that's it from the mailbag.
Now, one of the very popular sections of the TechNet is the space report. We get a lot of very positive mail that people just like knowing what NASA, European Space Agency, European Southern Observatory, and Japan Space Agency, and the Russian Space Agency, what all these guys are doing. And let me drop this. And I, for one, am really looking forward to the James Webb Space Telescope, infrared telescope, with this huge mirror. And the telescope is going to be mounted a million miles away from the Earth, on the backside of the moon, so to speak, and Lagrange point number two. It's going to look through all that dust and see the center of those galaxies in ways that we never see before. Whenever you put a brand new high-performance optical, radio, infrared, ultraviolet, whatever, telescope in space, you always find things you never anticipated. Truth is stranger than fiction when it comes to what's going on in space, what's really what Mother Nature has supplied to us. She hasn't given us a simple puzzle here. Understanding this solar system, galaxy, galactic group, universe, multiverse, to understand all that stuff. How did we get here? Are we alone? And whatever. There's no end to those questions. It ain't simple. But the answers are exciting if you've got an interest in the science. How did we get here? The art of some of these beautiful pictures that some of these machines can produce. So we got a lot to look forward to. John, you and I have got to we got to eat lots of vegetables, get lots of sleep, get enough exercise, make sure we stay alive long enough to see these great pieces of hardware deployed and starting to give us the results. I'm only half kidding when I say some of these things. Got the OS2N, Paul, K2RZ, you can go right ahead with the space report number 207. You got it, Paul.
Good evening, Dick, John, everybody else. This is WS2N, space report 207, yeah. I think one reason people are interested in what's going on in all the orbital satellites, all the probes going to the different planets, is because they do transmit to them. And, you know, it's digital pictures coming down, and it's all, I think, very fascinating. And they've improved so much. Voyages to send its pictures, it was one line at a time, very, very slow. Now, you know, when these spacecraft go to land on Mars and pictures start coming back, they just flash on the screen one right after the other, so it's pretty cool. Usually I mention what's coming up. I know you're talking about James Webb Space Telescope. That's all the way in September of 2018. That's a long way to wait. Let me drop it. It'll be launched in September from Kourou, French Guiana, down in South America. That's quite a European space agency on an Ariane 5 rocket, and it'll be the only satellite on board. Most of the satellites now launched by the Ariane 5 is usually dual or more satellites, but this will be dedicated just to the James Webb Space Telescope. And then a month or so after that, to deploy everything, 80 some odd different things have to move or come apart, or it's going to be a mechanical nightmare to get this thing to open up properly over a one-month period of time as it goes out to L2. That's a ways away. I'm thinking more of interplanetary science right now, and that'll be July 4th, coming up in a couple of days. And that's when the Juno spacecraft, I know we've talked about that many times, the Juno is the spacecraft that's going to go into polar orbit, starting from the North Pole, going down to the South Pole of Jupiter on July 4th. I'm sure that will make the news. Not too much stuff makes the news nowadays in the space world, but that's got to make the news. I think that's big. It's bigger than probably about the size of a tractor trailer, you know, end to end on the solar panels, about 120 feet. The box alone that protects the electronics, made out of titanium, and I think it was gold or an alloy, is 1-inch thick, and it's a big box. It's not like a little box with a couple of electronic things, and the size of it is pretty big. And it's mounted on this octagon bus that everything was built on. And that thing itself weighs 400 pounds. So, you know, picture the weight of a small piano. Then it's a piano. And that's just the weight of the box. It's got a propulsion on board. It's going to slow itself down as it nears the North Pole. It'll slow itself down with a 35-minute burn on its propulsion rocket. Before it does that, it's going to shut down everything, any kind of cameras, any kind of detectors, everything's going to be shut down. The only thing that's going to be on is if it has to do with getting into orbit. So once it does that, after about a day, it's going to take to get from the point of entering until we hear back from it that it successfully got into orbit. Probably, I guess, the night of July 4th, maybe we'll hear something from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and that will be handling the Juno spacecraft. So I had to mention that. More immediate, this Tuesday coming up, it's not a launch, but a test of the SLS booster. The SLS is the Space Launch System. that will eventually take astronauts to distant places. The asteroid, the moon, maybe Mars, maybe one of the moons of Mars. It will eventually do some unmanned missions, really thinking about using the SLS system to launch Europa Express to Jupiter, wherever Europa is, one of the moons, and they've upgraded that mission. They plan on doing 44 orbits of Jupiter, and each time it goes around, it goes very close to the planet Europa. Now they've upgraded that whole mission, and they plan on putting a lander on that. Land on Europa. Hopefully everything works out with politics and everything the way things are. You know, funding of all these different projects. But right now they have a go on that unless somebody gets into office and says, let's make some cutbacks. So, you know, and then that holds true with everything else. But we'll see. We don't want to see what happened last time. The Constellation program was well underway, and that was planned mission to return to the moon by the United States, and that was all canceled and changed to the SLS program. And probably one of the best things that they did is they started to fund seed money to the private companies to start launching not only cargo but people from the United States. And from
repeater timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, the first place they plan on going to is the ISS. And meanwhile, the private companies will have spacecraft built. They'll be able to use it not only for NASA, but they'll use it for their own purposes. If somebody else happens to put up a space station, they can go visit it. No problem. They could do their own science launches, put science equipment into their orbital spacecraft, and if they'd like, and they'll be on their own. So you'll have many spacecraft going up. You'll have Dragon by SpaceX. You'll have Cygnus by Orbital ATK for a cargo ship. Another cargo ship will be Dream Chaser by SNC, that's Sierra Nevada Corporation. They'll be sending up cargo. Also from the United States, we'll have Boeing developing the Starliner, and that will be a vehicle to dock with the International Space Station. But this is all start, you know, you'll start to see unmanned launches probably the end of 2017, probably starting with SpaceX. I'm looking forward to that. Let me drop it. Well, I started to mention coming up Tuesday, 10:30 in the morning, actually 10:35. You'll see it on the NASA channel, if you can get that on your computer. I have an app that I bring up, automatically brings up the NASA, whatever is on NASA TV at the time. And they'll be transmitting that test live. And what that is, you know, how you had on the space shuttle, you had two boosters to the port and starboard side of the external tank, the shuttle mounted on top of the onto the side of the whole setup. You had those two boosters. Well, they used to have four segments, and they were the real powerhouse to get the really basically get the fuel off the ground in the external tank that fed the shuttle. Now you've got these two boosters. They've made them bigger, roughly the same diameter, but they're adding another section. Instead of four sections, it's five sections. So you have more fuel to get heavier weights to orbit, and this will be part of the space launch system that will eventually be carrying the Orion spacecraft with astronauts. You'll have the tank, which will look similar to the external tank that they used to use for the shuttle, and to the port starboard side, you'll have have the SLS boosters, then on top of everything, you'll have the actual Orion spacecraft. So this should be interesting. And that won't happen probably the next the actual launch. The first launch test will be the end.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You probably have 2.5 years before you actually see a launch of the SLS, but you can watch this booster. It's going to be laying horizontally on the, in Utah. It's not going to go anywhere. They have, it'll be, you know, 3.5 million pounds of thrust. They'll be launching, firing off one of the boosters. They did the other test with another booster last March. And they're doing another test now. This time they're going to cool it down to 40 degrees Fahrenheit before they test it. They've had three big air conditioning units, big chillers hooked up to them, running for a month now, trying to cool the booster down. But on Tuesday morning, they'll fire it off. And I saw the last test last March. It's pretty cool. I mean, it doesn't go anywhere, but it's... They claim there'll be about 10,000 people that will go out and watch this thing. And it'll produce all this 3.5 million pounds of thrust. Can't go anywhere. It's all bolted down. It's attached to 13 million pounds of concrete. Thousands of degrees go out the back. They say the sand, that when it hits the sand in Utah, it's going to turn it to glass. So... that's what happened last time. There's plenty of other things going on. A CubeSat, an amateur CubeSat was launched by India. India just launched. They have their own rocket, the PL Polo launch vehicle, they call it. So that went off a couple of days ago, and it had 20 satellites. It's a record for India. They launched 20 satellites at one time. And one of the satellites, actually a couple of the satellites, were ham radio related. But this one that's supposed to be pretty good. And most people that get email from the ARRL could probably read that. And what frequencies it has, I have it here. You know, it's coming down on 70 centimeters. But it's a store and forward type of CubeSat. So... but really the point I'm trying to make is India has their own space program. They're developing a manned space program. China is well on the way. They've had a manned space program for quite a while. They'll be launching their second iteration of the space station coming up in a couple of months. So a lot going on, Dick. I'll pass it back to you. K2RIW, this is WS2. I missed you at field day, but we probably weren't there at the right time. I was there in the daytime.
Yeah, there was one time that you and I met simultaneously at Limelock at nighttime. I think I got there. It was the second field day site I visited, and I think I got there like 10 o'clock at night, left at around midnight, and went to Great South Bay. Now, Great South Bay, one of the hams there had built a full-scale model of CubeSat. I think CubeSat is 4 inches by 4 inches by 4 inches. Now, that's 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters, or was it 20 centimeters? Anyhow, 4 inches by 4 inches by 4 inches. And so we had a full-scale mock-up of those CubeSats. Tiny-looking thing for a satellite. And run that by again. How many were launched all at once? And some of them are ham radio. And I know that the Great South Bay group did make some satellite QSOs during the field day, which gave them an extra 1,000 points, I think it is, bonus points. And I'm not sure whether or not they were going to make an attempt to communicate with a CubeSat. So, how many CubeSats were launched? How many of them were ham radio? And have we had reports that those are in the active mode and doing their thing up all? WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Well, there were 20 satellites launched at one time, but their main satellite was some type of reconnaissance, you know, regular satellite, and they launched a 97-degree inclination, so it's almost like a retrograde type of launch. But it's a polar orbit for all these satellites. And one I noticed on one website, and then later it came up on ARRL, you know, the emails that they sent out was this Swamyam. It's SWAYAM-1, the name of the, you know, the CubeSat. And it'll be transmitting on 70 centimeters, 437.025. Only I've got one watt of power, but that's the way these things are. But, you know, a lot of young people are building these things, colleges and high schools. And there was one not too long ago built by a Catholic school, St. Thomas More in Virginia, that went up. That was a great school. It's good. It gets a lot of people interested in the space program, engineering, and all of that. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, all these CubeSats, did I remember correctly that they are 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters? Roughly how many were launched, and how many of them are ham radio or pole grid?
Oh, okay. Yeah, there was, let's see, there's the BSAT, that's one, another one, GMSK, whatever it was. Oh, no, that was the mode. 1, 2, Virostat, that's 2, 3, 4, I count 5 plus the other one I mentioned before, so probably 6. 6 of them were probably ham radio related there. So, yeah, and they're all 4-inch, you know, like you said, 10 centimeters cubed. The reason for that is, sometimes they'll put 2 or 3 of them together, put them in these launches, and the launches are made for that size. So that's how they get that. When the SLS goes up, that I was mentioning before, you know, on a test flight, on first one's going to be unmanned at the end of 2018, they're going to put that, well, it's going to go out to the moon, you know, and eventually come back. And on that, they're going to release, they've already, you know, figured out which satellites, who's going to be doing this. They're going to be launching CubeSats by the moon orbit. There's also a couple that are eventually going to go to Mars, by the way, too. So, but I don't think they have a group that's going to do those. But yeah, 10 centimeter cube.
So of the CubeSats that were recently launched, approximately 6 of them are ham radio. What's the total number of CubeSats that were launched up over there?
Oh, I can't answer that. I don't know. Some of the satellites, you know, are, you know, India wants, I think, to keep quiet, probably, with some of them. So I don't know. See if I have a list. No, I don't have that list. But, you know, it's the heavy lift vehicle. So their main satellite took up the main portion of the payload. So they call it the Polar Satellite Launch Vehicle, PSLV. They're doing pretty good with that. Got a lot of, many launches. I think they've been going up once every couple of months. They from that vehicle, they launched a satellite that's now orbiting Mars. So it's called MOM, M-O-M, Mars Orbital Mission. So India is really on their way. That's why we can't drop the ball. You know, we're still ahead, but, you know, we don't want to have any of these countries eventually catch up and pass us, especially China. You know, nice to keep ahead of these countries. Back to you, Dick.
These CubeSats and the MOM were launched into this, I think it's a 97-degree inclination orbit, which is partially retrograde, but almost polar. Were they launched at a high altitude pole? Are these satellites going to last for a long time? Or they were somewhat low altitude, and therefore the air drag is going to bring them down in the next year. What's your guess as to the altitude and circularity of that 97 degree orbit? WS2N, K2RAW.
They should be up there a while. I think they were almost 400 miles up. So they'll be up there a while. You know, now, whether some of the satellites sometimes they'll launch at different times during the mission. So I don't know what the Keplerian numbers are going to be for that satellite, or even if what the Oscar number eventually becomes. And when I mentioned the MOM mission, that was a while back. Just to give you an idea of how India is getting more advanced, they launched that mission, I guess, a couple of years ago now. So that's already in orbit around Mars and still operating. That's called the Mars Orbital Mission, or MOM, and actually has this long Indian name. That's what I'm trying to say. Their main satellite that they launched now was some name I've got to begin with a C. I have to look that up. But that was their reconnaissance type of satellite. I don't know if it's going to be a spy satellite or, you know, whatever. It's just like we have them. They want their own. Back to you, Dick.
Now I'm going to go back to Juno for a minute. July 4th, Juno is going to whiz by Jupiter, do a 35-minute burn to slow down from some ridiculously high speed to get into Jupiter's orbit. I think it's going to start off as a highly elliptical orbit. But during the perigee of that orbit, I think you tell us that it's going to be taking some pretty hard look with some good telescopes at the moon Europa. There are four so-called Galileo moons, Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto, going around Jupiter. Back in around 1612, on a very early crude telescope that Galileo used, looking at Jupiter, let me drop. And he sees these four moons, which we now call the Galileo moons, going around Jupiter. Suddenly realized that, hey, we're at the center of the universe. And these epicycles are coming up to try to explain the way the planets are moving around. It's getting much too complicated. So although he got in a lot of trouble, so those moons going around Jupiter and realized, hey, what we now call the Copernican method of explaining the solar system as opposed to the Ptolemaic system, where the Earth, we thought it was the center. Boy, have we been humbled quite a few times since then, but at the center of anything, even though we think we are. So the second moon, Europa, I think is the one that we believe has got a pretty thick ice shell and most likely water underneath, living mechanisms underneath. So that satellite, Juno, is going to take some better looks. And now this is the proposal of the space probe. Let me drop it. Depending on what Juno sees and whether or not we can continue to get the funding, there's going to be a space probe in the future that really goes to Europa, in order to maybe dig through the ice, maybe look at the water underneath, maybe make measurements of is there microbial life, is there life on Europa. So the moon Europa going around Jupiter could be a significant place in this solar system where maybe life had a chance to form, and maybe it's there. So give me some words on the proposed mission, if it continues to get funding, to Europa. What are they proposing to do to make a much better study of Europa, Paul? WS2N, K2RAW, the TechNet.
Okay, well, first of all, Juno has these instruments on board. They want to find out what Jupiter's all about. They're going to peer below the clouds. They're going to get as close as 2,900 miles to the clouds, closer than any other spacecraft has ever done. So on board this Juno is a camera, the Juno camera. And apparently there are some people something to do with different people, organizations, colleges, whatever, they get a chance to point or have them point the camera in certain directions, you know, over the lifetime of the mission. So they're calling it the people's camera. But I just saw a picture that came back, I guess, yesterday or the day before, and it was a... It's approaching Jupiter now. It's like 5 million miles away. But in the picture, it had all those four Galileo moons all in one shot. And you just see the different bands on Jupiter starting to appear. So that's going to be pretty good pictures when it gets up close. Now, Juno is going to go into a polar orbit. Let me drop this. This is WS2N. And it'll stay there, and it's really going to concentrate on the planet itself. I haven't heard much about taking pictures of planets. I was actually surprised that this came out with a picture of all four planets. I hope they do, but from what I understand, it's really going to concentrate on Jupiter. Now, this thing is the size of a basketball court. That's the way the one guy put it. It's a good, you know, it takes up a lot of square feet. It's going to be putting out 400 watts of power to power this thing, which doesn't sound like much, but to get solar panels to operate at that distance, it's good enough. So it'll be in an elliptical orbit, and it'll keep getting closer, you know, the planet. Every time it does, it'll do more research. Now, the other planned one that they have, I think it's going to go on the SLS Space Launch System when that's built. That's going to be called Europa Clipper, unless they change the name between now and then. And once that gets into orbit, of course, Jupiter has this very high radiation problem. You know, super duper Van Allen belt, and it would kill spacecraft if you stayed in it too long. So that's why Juno has this bulletproof box built around the electronics. And I would imagine Europa Express will probably have the same type of thing, but they just can't leave it in a low orbit. So that's going to be. They're going to go near the moon and then far away again. And this is going to happen 44 times. And this way the radiation won't be there long enough, you know, to affect the spacecraft. It'll only be there when it gets close to Europa. And with that, one of the passes, probably, you know, the first or second pass, they'll release a probe and send it down to the moon. That was a plan like decades ago that they wanted to do this. Then I heard it was all canceled. It's going to be too expensive, no probe. And now in the last year, I heard they got an approval for that. So that should be pretty cool. Now Europa, you know, if anybody watches the science fiction shows, I believe it was 2010, second, very, you know, after 2001 Space Odyssey, they had 2010. One of the things they said is, you know, the message was, you know, from the so-called alien race, it was do not, you know, land ever, do not ever go back to Europa. Everything else is yours, but you can't go to Europa. Meanwhile, that's where we're going to go. That's pretty cool. Also, another good movie I saw, which is based on actually landing people on Europa, called the Europa Report. It's a pretty good movie. Neil deGrasse Tyson has a cameo appearance in that movie. He's talking about the planet. But again, it's science fiction, but it's a good movie. It shows, you know, and Tyson made some statements. He said, you know, they had it right the way they planned on landing and, you know, how they're going to go about doing this, and what kind of instruments they're going to use, looking for life and everything, drilling through the water, through the ice. So it's hard to find. I had to go to the library and have them get it for me, call the Roper report. Back to you, Dick. WS200.
Bob, of all the pictures that have been taken by various spacecraft of Europa, is Europa the moon around Jupiter that has been shown to have occasional geysers?